It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Britain's Prime Minister calls Ebola the worst health crisis in years. The World Health Organization says the death toll is now approaching 4,500. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. British Prime Minister David Cameron, who took part in a video conference with European leaders and President Obama, Wednesday said the Ebola outbreak is the worst global health crisis in years. He says the international community needs to do more and quickly. His views echoed by the UN Security Council, which said in a statement unanimously, the global community must accelerate and dramatically expand aid to West African countries battling the epidemic. The World Health Organization Wednesday revised the number of deaths and cases of Ebola upward. Nearly 4,500 in seven countries have died since March, while close to 9,000 cases have been confirmed. The majority of those cases remain in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, where the WHO says the situation continues to deteriorate. Tarek Yasarevich is a WHO spokesman.
The number of cases doubles every 4 weeks. So if we do not step up the response, if we let it go as it goes now, we could have anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000 cases per week in December. So this is something we do not want to see.
Liberia remains the hardest hit nation with more than 2,500 fatalities, but the UN Health Agency believes the number of cases in the capital Monrovia remains significantly underreported. The WHO says the number of cases in Guinea appears to be falling. In Sierra Leone, transmission of the disease remains rampant, with the capital Freetown and two neighboring western districts the hardest hit. Meanwhile, Guinean President Alpha Conde's government issued a call to retired doctors to return to work to help the country's overstretched health system. This is VOA News. Authorities in Sierra Leone have launched a massive awareness campaign, but many families still harbor sick people in their homes and bury their dead without assistance. They're also refusing to call the Ebola response line 117. Police official Mustafa Lahai Wednesday took part in one of the outreach programs to the Western Freetown community of Aberdeen.
So the only thing people need to do is to put in place some preventive mechanism. So if you see us all out here, it is as a result of trying to take measures that will help us increase, one, the level of awareness and level of cooperation, coordination and collaboration, so that those suspected cases of Ebola can be spotted, can be traced, and reduce the level of transmission.
A second, smaller Ebola outbreak has been going on in Democratic Republic of Congo since July, with 69 known cases and 49 deaths. A study in the New England Journal of Medicine conducted by the WHO Canada and France showed the virus has a different source. Study says the virus is close to the Zaire strain that caused previous outbreaks. Following the disclosure of a second healthcare worker infected with Ebola in the U.S. state of Texas Wednesday, President Obama vowed a more aggressive response to domestic cases. But he said the world cannot lose sight of the importance of the international response to what is taking place in West Africa.
I am absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak of the disease here in the United States. But it becomes more difficult to do so if this epidemic of Ebola rages out of control in West Africa. If it does, then it will spread globally.
European Union health ministers are set to meet in Brussels today to discuss their response to the Ebola epidemic. Voting irregularities have been alleged by two of Mozambique's opposition parties as people cast ballots Wednesday in an election expected to keep the country's ruling Frelimo party in power. European Union observer Judith Sargentini said the voting was mostly calm.
European observers that were in all provinces seen a couple of issues that were not perfect. We had one team refused to enter a polling station in Tete, but I would say, aside from the incidents until now, and let's see the closing and the counting, but until now it's been rather calm.
Frelimo has ruled the former Portuguese colony since independence in 1975. Two car bombs in Somalia's capital Mogadishu killed at least seven people, including a national intelligence officer. The militant group Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for both Wednesday blasts. The group has steadily lost territory to African Union forces, but continues to launch gun and bombing attacks in the capital. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A second U.S. nurse has been infected with Ebola as President Obama assures Americans that the risk of widespread outbreak is very low.
I am absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak of the disease here in the United States. But it becomes more difficult to do so if this epidemic of Ebola rages out of control in West Africa.
We'll talk with the director of the first Ebola Children's Interim Care Center in Liberia. Human rights groups criticize South Sudan's new security bill. And we'll update you on yesterday's presidential election in Mozambique as the nation awaits the results.
We appeal the people of Mozambique for serenity, to be calm and await for the announcement of the results.
Paulo Quinica is the spokesman for Mozambique's National Electoral Commission, and will examine the challenges facing the ICC as it tries to prosecute a sitting president. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. President Barack Obama says the risk of a widespread Ebola outbreak in the United States is very, very low if all the proper protections are taken. Mr. Obama canceled his trip plans Wednesday, his travel plan Wednesday for an emergency cabinet meeting after news that a second health worker who treated Liberian Ebola patient Thomas Eric Duncan had been infected with the virus. Mr. Obama called for an emergency federal medical team to be immediately deployed to any hospital where an Ebola case is diagnosed.
First of all, what I've directed the CDC to do is that as soon as somebody is diagnosed with Ebola, we want a rapid response team, a SWAT team, essentially from the CDC to be on the ground as quickly as possible, hopefully within 24 hours, so that they are taking the local hospital step by step through exactly what needs to be done. The key thing to understand about this disease is that these protocols work. We know that because they've been used for decades now in Ebola cases around the world.
President Obama stressed the need for a more robust global response to Ebola. This, he says, includes more aid to the three countries at the epicenter of the outbreak, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
We are going to have to make sure that we do not lose sight of the importance of the international response to what is taking place in West Africa. I am absolutely confident that we can prevent a serious outbreak of the disease here in the United States. But it becomes more difficult to do so if this epidemic of Ebola rages out of control in West Africa. If it does, then it will spread globally in an age of frequent travel and the kind of constant interactions that people have across borders. And so it is very important for us to understand that the investment we make in helping Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea deal with this problem is an investment in our own public health.
Mr. Obama expressed concern for the two Texas nurses and said authorities have to make sure that they are doing everything to take care of healthcare providers. The World Health Organization said this week that there could be up to 10,000 Ebola cases per week by December this year in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, three countries that are the epicenter of the outbreak. But what becomes of Ebola orphans? It is estimated that about 90,000 children in West Africa have been affected by Ebola, and about 900 of those are in Liberia. Child Fund, an international development organization that focuses on promoting children's well-being, has teamed up with Liberia's Ministry of Health and Social Welfare to launch the first Children's Interim Care Center in Monrovia. Billy Ambimbila is Child Fund's National Director for Liberia and Sierra Leone. He said his organization and the Ministry of Health hope to establish more centers throughout the country.
What we do is that we try to provide care support and protection to these children for whom there is no family-based option. For a quarantine period of 21 days, from the day in which the lab has close contact with a person diagnosed for Ebola.
This is not necessarily children who have lost their parents to Ebola, but this is also children whose parents have been quarantined.
That is right. And like I said, it is children who have come into contact with somebody we know has suffered from Ebola, whether they are still alive in the Ebola treatment centers or whether they have died since then. What we do is that we observe and monitor the children closely for the development of Ebola symptoms, probably twice daily, by testing their temperature and looking at the symptoms associated with Ebola, and then to take immediate action when the symptoms begin to appear.
So about how many children do you have now in the center?
We have now 20 children who have been brought into the center for such care for a period of up to 21 days.
So what happens after 21 days? Do you release the children to their parents?
Now, within the 21 days, if some of them develop the symptoms, there is a mechanism for immediate referral to the nearest Ebola treatment center, and there are ambulances on standby that can be called at very short notice to send these to the center. However, if by the 21 days there are no signs or symptoms that they have been infected by Ebola, then we trace their families and reunite them with their families. And if their families are not there, they may be close relatives.
What type of staff do you have dealing with these children?
I must say that Child Fund is collaborating very closely with the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare in the running of this center. What the ministry has done is to try and look for survivors who would have developed immunity against Ebola to be caregivers at this center to reduce the risk to any person who would come in contact with these children.
Thinking that because of the number of people who have been affected by Ebola in Liberia, that probably there's going to be a need for more centers like this.
It is estimated that over 90,000 children have been affected in West Africa in so many ways. But in Liberia, it's estimated today that close to 900 would need this kind of care. So we would be, again, trying to open another center in Monrovia and others in Bong and Lufa.
Billy Ambimbila is Child Fund's National Director for Liberia and Sierra Leone and coordinator of the Children's Ebola Interim Care Center. He spoke with us from Monrovia. Mozambique's National Electoral Commission will soon begin announcing provisional results of Wednesday's presidential, parliamentary and local elections following a relatively peaceful vote, says Paulo Quinica, spokesman for the electoral body, says counting of the ballots began shortly after the polls ended. Quinica tells reporter Peter Clotty that the national results of the general elections must be announced 15 days after election day.
If the Electoral Commission have 72 hours to announce the results at the district level and the Provincial Electoral Commission 5 days to announce it, whilst the Electoral Commission at the national level have to announce it within 15 days from today. But as the results will be coming out, will be announced at the press center, which is prepared to receive the results from the different polling stations. And so partially, we will be announcing the results as they will be pouring in.
How did our Mozambicans comport themselves during polling on Wednesday?
The polling went smooth generally, but we had some challenges in a few places, like in Tsangano, where we don't yet have a full report, but we understand that the situation was not that calm. But in general, the election went very well. People are very enthusiastic. The turnout early in the morning was very high, slowed down during the lunchtime, but again, it's very high at close to the closing time.
How credible do you think this election would be, looking at how intense the parties contested this particular poll?
We have not received any formal complaint from the political parties because the political parties are represented by polling officers and also by their representatives. So we would expect that this representation is able to follow all the procedures of the elections, and therefore we don't see many complaints about the elections.
Talk to me about activities leading up to the election. Did the political parties abide by the electoral code set by the Electoral Commission in conjunction with the political parties?
It's very peaceful. There was a lot of collaboration from the political parties themselves. That's how we ended up with 30 political parties contesting the election. And yet, the political parties are part of the whole process. As such, we did not have any complaints during the process that led to today's election.
So what message will the Electoral Commission will be giving to the people of Mozambique as they await the counting of the result?
We appeal the people of Mozambique for serenity, to be calm and await for the announcement of the result.
Paulo Quinica is the spokesman for Mozambique's National Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Maputo. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, October 16. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. Wednesday's Mozambique presidential election could determine how the country handles its fate as a burgeoning energy producer, but the poll is still overshadowed by the civil war in which two groups clashed for decades, first on the battlefield and then as political parties. But in the capital, both parties expressed optimism, with both major candidates making high-profile appearances. From Mozambique's capital, Maputo, viewers Anita Powell brings us this report.
Frelimo candidate Felipe Nyusi strolled confidently into the packed Maputo polling station Wednesday morning in a sharp suit and a red tie, looking every inch a president. Analysts widely predict that his party, which touts itself as Mozambique's liberator and has won every election for decades, will again triumph in this vote. The relatively obscure Nyusi is being marketed as the continuity candidate, taking the mantle from President Armando Guebuza, who has served his maximum two terms. Frelimo has vowed to keep the Southern African nation on a course of investment and growth amid the discovery of massive gas deposits. It took Nyusi less than 30 seconds in the cardboard booth to mark the two ballots, one a long list of parliamentary party contenders and another shorter form with the mugshots of three men, including his own. Afterwards, he addressed the media from an improvised podium, surrounded by red velvet cordons and hefty security men. I voted, he said, for the future of my country. His rival, Afonso Dhlakama, also made quite the entrance half an hour earlier, also looking like the president he has tried so hard to become for five successive elections. Dhlakama is a compelling figure. He emerged from hiding just before the vote and commanded huge crowds at rallies. On Wednesday, he was mobbed by the media. The diminutive candidate even got whacked in the head by an overzealous cameraman. As the longtime leader of the Renamo party, he has complained that his party has been marginalized and denied a share of the nation's wealth. Frelimo's critics share the complaint, but some also point out that Renamo has never managed to form a compelling enough political alternative and too often resorts to threats of violence. Dhlakama said he was confident of victory this time.
We hope that this time, for first time, we can have free and fair election in this country. We hope that we can see that. My campaign was endful, 100%. If a campaign means that someone won, I can say that I won.
Early reports from around the country indicate high turnout, but some journalists noted what they said were serious problems, mainly in the form of delays in opposition strongholds in the north. Anita Powell, VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
If you live in South Sudan's Jonglei state, you face a number of challenges, not the least of which is security and the consequences of the new national security bill. Local and international human rights agencies have called on President Salva Kiir to veto the controversial bill approved by the country's parliament last week. Wakit Simon Wudu of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program has the details from Juba.
Amnesty International, Enough Project, Human Rights Watch, and other human rights groups say the bill grants the National Security Service sweeping powers and violates the National Transitional Constitution as well as international human rights laws. Elizabeth Asamu-Deng, a researcher with Amnesty International, says the version of the bill passed by Parliament on October 8th should be sent back to the committee dealing with national security for major revisions.
While a number of changes were made to the bill in the most recent reading, including some positive changes, we remain concerned that the bill provides National Security Service with virtually unfettered powers, and that its powers are not limited. So we're calling on the Legislative Assembly to amend the bill.
Then calls the bill unconstitutional.
The bill grants the National Security Service with powers to arrest, detain, conduct searches, and seize property. We believe that these powers are unconstitutional.
Speaker Manasi Magok Rundial used his considerable influence and, according to sources in the parliament building, untwisted MPs behind closed doors who had been opposed to the bill to suddenly switch their votes and vote for it. A majority of MPs were reported to have walked out of the session in protest, accusing Speaker Rundial of failing to follow proper parliamentary procedures for passing bills in parliament. Despite numerous calls from human rights groups to reject the bill, officials say President Salva Kiir will sign the bill into law, arguing that a responsible organ of government, the parliament, has already ratified it. Michael Makwe is the Minister of Information and Broadcasting and the chief spokesman for the government.
This is a law which was passed by the parliament and the government. The president will sign it into law. If there are any loopholes, then definitely what is usually done, you pass a law. If there are any loopholes, then you correct them later. You fill the gap, if there are any gaps at all.
By law, President Salva Kiir is expected to sign into law any bill passed by parliament within 3 months. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wodo reporting from Juba.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta made history last week as the first sitting head of state to appear before the International Criminal Court at The Hague. Despite this, the prosecution said its case against Mr. Kenyatta for allegedly orchestrating deadly election-related violence in Kenya is falling apart. Hilary Hewler has more for VOA on the unique challenges of prosecuting a world leader who still wields influence.
Uhuru Kenyatta isn't the first powerful man to be indicted by the ICC, but Mr. Kenyatta is currently leading a country, and that brings with it a different set of issues, not just those of sorting out legal precedents, but dealing with the power and influence his position brings. A lawyer for some of the Kenyan victims of the violence, Fergal Gaynor, says Mr. Kenyatta's trial has been very different.
This is a case involving an extensive set of steps taken by the Kenyan state, headed by the accused, to obstruct the emergence of truth and the course of justice.
The prosecution has admitted at the October 8th hearing that it has scant evidence against Mr. Kenyatta, but says that's because the government is obstructing the investigation. Prosecution attorney Benjamin Gumpert told the court the evidence does exist, but says prosecutors need access to financial and phone records.
We know that there are 33 months' worth of bank statements which have not been provided under compulsion or otherwise. We know that material is available, but we can't consider it. Why? Because we are being obstructed from doing so.
Kenya's Attorney General insists the government has been doing everything possible to cooperate with the ICC. But accusations of obstruction have dogged the case from the start. The prosecution also says key witnesses in Kenya are being intimidated, and several have already withdrawn their testimony. Eric Mutua, chairman of the Law Society of Kenya, says that with someone so powerful in the dock, such problems are bound to arise.
You're trying someone who is influential in terms of politics, You're trying someone who has money. You're trying someone who has the police machinery at his disposal. And he can use a lot of influence. He can use a lot of force, intimidation, very many avenues to silence either witnesses, to silence any other persons who are pursuing the case on the side of the prosecution.
Kenya's witness protection program is run by the government, says Mutua, and could easily have been compromised in this case. Other key institutions report directly to the president as well, he adds, including the Attorney General and the police force. That's where the ICC is supposed to come in, to be able to facilitate justice when an impartial trial may not be possible in the country where the crimes took place. Kenya is a signatory to the Rome Statutes that created the court, and as such is legally obliged to cooperate with the ICC. But asking the Kenyan government to help convict its own leader could be expecting too much, says Mutua. While the prosecution has asked for an indefinite adjournment, Mr. Kenyatta's defense team is pushing for the case to be dropped completely. Hilary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Striker Deborah Engana-Moit scored in each half to propel Cameroon to a 2-0 triumph over Algeria as South Africa and Ghana drew 1-1 in Group B action at the Telkom Namibia Mobile African Women's Championship at the Sam Nujoma Stadium in Windhoek, Namibia on Wednesday. Meanwhile, Cape Verde Islands pipped Mozambique 1-0 as Algeria beat Malawi 3-0 in their 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers on Wednesday. Cape Verde Islands and Algeria have qualified for the 2015 Nations Cup. Elsewhere, Egypt dismissed Botswana 2-0, Burkina Faso and Gabon drew 1-1, Togo edged Uganda 1-0, South Africa and Republic of Congo drew 0-0, Zambia outclassed Niger 3-0, Cameroon outplayed Sierra Leone 2-0, and Ethiopia surprised Mali 3-2. The Democratic Republic of Congo edged Ivory Coast 4-3, Ghana beat Guinea 3-1, Tunisia pipped Senegal 1-0, as African champions Nigeria outplayed Sudan 3-1 and Angola overpowered Lesotho 4-0. Here in South Africa, former South African President Frederick de Klerk is among the country's previous heads of state who recently received an award from the South Africa Football Association for their contribution to the success of the 2010 FIFA World Cup in South Africa. De Klerk says staging a successful World Cup shows the potential the country can achieve.
The award should actually have been presented to the South African people as a whole, because they, in my opinion, were the real stars of the 2010 World Cup. For a magical few weeks, they showed the successful outcomes we can achieve and the goodwill that we can generate when we South Africans work together for a common goal. I believe we should free ourselves from the divisive approaches that increasingly set some South Africans against each other. Maybe the best starting point really would be, as we did with the World Cup, identify our strengths, identify our weaknesses, highlight our strengths, improve there where we are weak. And if we do that with the economy, and if we have a World Cup approach to attract again investment from across the world, South Africa, as in 2010, can and will be a winner again.
That was Frederick de Klerk, a former South African head of state, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Two car bombs in Somalia's capital have killed at least 7 people, including a national intelligence officer. That's it for this Thursday, October 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotin and Ricky Strack, as well as post editor Mark Ouma, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butte, wishing all of you in Africa a good day.
Love African music?
Music time in Africa.
This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa through its own music. Oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.